In this second hour of Midday, we'll catch up with Baltimore Sun reporter John Fritzy, who's tracking the candidates, declared and undeclared, for Barbara Mikulski's long-held U.S. Senate seat. With at least two members of Congress seeking the Democratic nomination, there's a scramble for the seats they'll be giving up in the House of Representatives. A prominent member of the Maryland General Assembly is the latest to declare his candidacy. And speaking of the General Assembly, is it going to take a special session of the legislature to settle a dispute with Governor Larry Hogan? WYPR's Chris Connolly tackles that question. And which Baltimore neighborhood produced two mayors and a speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives? A lot of what you ought to know about Little Italy when Midday Friday continues after the news. Welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks for sticking around for our second hour. If you've dined out in Baltimore, you've probably been to Little Italy at some point to either have a big meal at one of the restaurants, a pizza from Isabella's, or maybe you've stood in line for cookies and gelati at Vaccaro's, or perhaps you opened a lawn chair and sat on the sidewalk to watch a summer movie. Little Italy is not as big as it used to be in terms of the Italian immigrants or Italian Americans who live there, but it survives, and the people who live there or still attend St. Leo's Church cling to their traditions, their bocce games, the St. Anthony and St. Gabriel festivals, and the annual ravioli and spaghetti dinner. Susanna Rosamolino joins us a little later in this hour to tell a more intimate story of Little Italy and its people, past and present, and to ruminate about its future. That'll be coming up later on in the show. First, some midday politics. Since last month, when Barbara Mikulski announced that she would not seek re-election to the U.S. Senate seat that she's held since the 1980s. There's been a lot of speculation about who would run this year and next year to replace her. Some candidates have filed and started campaigning. Some are still pondering a run and looking at polls. John Fritzy, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, has been covering the early part of this campaign. We thought we'd catch up with him today. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, let's go over the roster. actually declared Democratic candidates for Mikulski's seat.
Right, so just two at this point. Rep. Chris Van Hollen of Montgomery County and Rep. Donna Edwards of Prince George's County. Interestingly, two downstate Democrats representing the Washington suburbs, one African-American woman, one a white guy who is in House leadership.
And interesting story today on the front page of the Sun about Donna Edwards going after Chris Van Hollen for a vote that takes a little bit of explaining to do. So go ahead, John.
Yeah, no, it's interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's interesting to see a candidate coming out to sort of criticize the other candidate's record so early. I think one of the interesting pieces of this race is that it's moving far faster than these races usually do. You have endorsements already coming in. There's a lot of money being raised. Things are moving quickly. In this particular instance, Congresswoman Edwards is going after Chris Van Hollen for his votes for these trade deals. Trade deals with international trading partners are generally not well liked by unions, liberal groups, and voters who turn out in primaries. And so it makes sense for Edwards to criticize him on that front. And it's part of her longstanding effort to try to position herself to the left of Chris Van Hollen. And look, if you look at this sort of scores that get done down near here, who's the most liberal, who's the most conservative, Congresswoman Edwards is often considered among the most liberal, if not the most liberal, member of the House. That's not to say Van Hollen's not liberal. He's often considered pretty far on the left of the Democratic caucus as well. But it's, so we're sort of talking about a level of degrees here, and Edwards is trying to exploit that. Closing the loop, Van Hollen would argue that he's had many concerns with these trade deals too, and that he's opposed a lot of provisions of them in the past as well.
So she's trying to pick up, of course, labor support.
Exactly, and that's one of the things, is an indication of what's happening quickly, is that you've already seen one labor group, a Teamsters union in Baltimore, come out for Van Hollen. I talked to Fred Mason, who's the head of the AFL-CIO in the state, and he said that they were getting started on their process as well. That's pretty early. I don't think we're going to see endorsements anytime soon, but I do think it's telling that you've got unions already starting the process of interviewing these candidates and thinking about endorsements, We're a year out from the primary.
A year out from the primary. It'll be April next year for Maryland in the presidential as well as these congressional seats. And speaking of congressional seats, so there's two members of Congress seeking the Democratic nomination to replace Barbara Mikulski, giving up their seats, which starts another scramble down below there. We'll get to that in just a minute. But there's potentially a third member of Congress who might run for this seat. Elijah Cummings says that he has a poll showing him to be number one.
Right. So this is the most important question right now, and that's because more than any other politician in the state, Elijah Cummings could change the dynamic of this race. He's a Baltimore congressman. He's been in for, I think, seven terms. He is an African-American who is very high numbers with white voters as well, so he sort of crosses the racial divide. He has a lot of money in his campaign account. He can raise money. He would be a very, very compelling figure. And he is certainly sending signals that he's interested in doing it. The poll, as you note, is one. He's been shopping that around. And, you know, anybody who asks him, he'll say that, look, I'm looking at it very seriously. He's also sending other signals that he may not do it. We just saw fundraising numbers this week. Mr. Cummings didn't really do any fundraising, which is a little bit surprising for someone thinking about a Senate campaign. And also, a lot of folks who follow this closely noted that when the Prince George's County Executive Rushen Baker endorsed Chris Van Hollen, many people think that he would have at least considered endorsing Elijah Cummings if Mr. Baker thought Cummings was going to get in. They have a pretty good relationship, and certainly Mr. Baker's endorsement is a very powerful thing. And so I think it's sort of telling that he went ahead and endorsed Van Hollen so early. That's merely speculation. But I think what I think is happening is that Cummings is sort of genuinely conflicted about whether he's going to do this or not, and we won't know until he does.
We're speaking with John Fritzi of the Baltimore Sun about the senatorial campaign. For the record, so far, no Republican has announced a candidacy for this seat.
Yeah, I think that's you're going to see that for a while. There's no advantage for a Republican to get in right now until the Democratic field gets settled. If you're a Republican candidate who wants to run for this, you kind of want to see how it's shaping up on the other side. This is going to be a tough seat in the general. And I think that's emblematic of why you don't see any Republicans. Another reason why you don't see Republicans getting in right now is that it's a tough seat for a Republican to win. Yes, Governor Hogan won last year, but in a presidential election, you're going to have a lot more Democrats turning out. And I think it's going to be very hard, not impossible, but very hard for a Republican to win this seat. So I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing potential candidates hold back. People talk about Andy Harris. He's the Eastern Shore congressman. Look, he can raise money. He's very popular among Republicans in the state. He's also pretty conservative. He's got a Republican drawn district, and that draws him to the right. And in Maryland, the history of a successful Republican candidate, Bobby Ehrlich, Governor Hogan, is more of a centrist Republican. And so I think that's a problem for Congressman Harris. And then it's not clear who the other Republican candidates might be. People have talked about Michael Steele, the former lieutenant governor. He would certainly be a compelling candidate if he wants to do it. The bench just isn't as deep in Maryland. So I think, you know, we'll eventually get one, but it's going to be a while.
I got a press release yesterday, which prompted me to call up John Fritzi or contact him by email and say, John, can you be on the show tomorrow? We need to catch up here. Because there's at least two members of Congress, Donna Edwards and Chris Van Hollen, seeking the Democratic nomination for the Senate, there's a scramble for the seats that they'll be giving up in the House of Representatives. And if Elijah Cummings does that, too, that'll make a third seat. But anyway, a prominent member of the Maryland General Assembly is the latest to declare his candidacy, Jamie Raskin. This is the press release that came in yesterday afternoon, launched his campaign for Congress in Maryland's 8th District. This is the Van Hollen seat.
Right. This is Montgomery County. It scoops up into Carroll County a little bit. This is Van Hollen's old seat. Yeah, I mean, so Senator Raskin's in. There's a guy named a state delegate named Kumar Barve, who has already gotten in. People have talked about Valerie Ervin, the former Montgomery County Council member, getting in. I think the great political story here is that for so many years in Maryland, there has been no movement. And with Mikulski's retirement, as you know, you have these House members running, and then you get a bunch of delegates and state lawmakers who are going to run. And what happens next as you go down the domino chain is that you're going to have these people that nobody's ever heard of on county councils and small boards who are going to run for those state lawmaker seats. And that's what I think is really interesting about this, is that there, you know, who is going to be the next governor in 10 years down the line who gets a shot at a state lawmaker seat this year because of Mikulski's retirement, who hasn't had one before. I think that's like the really fascinating part about this for Maryland. So yeah, the 8th has got a few candidates already in. I suspect more will get in. The 4th district, which is Donna Edwards' seat, there are several candidates already in that. Former Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, former Prince George's County State's Attorney Glenn Ivey, several others. There's a couple of state lawmakers in there. One thing to keep in mind is that the federal elections are off cycle for the state, right? So what that means is that if you're a state lawmaker, you can run for a Congress seat and not give up your state house seat. So there's not much risk, and I expect you'll see a lot of state lawmakers running for these house seats just to sort of raise their name ID, raise their profile, open up a federal account, raise some money. But if they don't win, nothing really lost for them.
Hmm. It may not mean very much at this point. You mentioned Glenn Ivey, the former Prince George's County State's Attorney. He's actually raised quite a bit of money. He's raised twice as much as the person we would, I guess, describe as his leading rival for the 4th Congressional District seat, now held by Donna Edwards. That's the former Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown.
Yes. I mean, this is a little bit surprising. People always criticize the press, including me, for sort of dwelling too much on the numbers. And I understand that criticism. Absent a poll, which we haven't seen any polls in any of these races, except for the Elijah Cummings poll, absent a poll, sort of the next best concrete thing you can look at is how much money are they raising? Because it tells you a couple of things. It tells you what sort of organization they have, how seriously they're taking it, and it also gives you some measure of idea of support, right? If they've got 1,000 donors giving in, well, you know, if those people live in Maryland, that's 1,000 voters most likely. So we do pay very close attention to the money, even though it's early. And yeah, it was a little bit surprising to see Ivy beating, to me anyway, to seeing Ivy beat Brown so badly. Brown, of course, will note, look, both of these campaigns were only raising for a few weeks. We're not really off the ground yet. You know, Brown just got done with the statewide campaign, which he was unsuccessful at, but he still has a base of donors. And I think Ivy has that too, and that's sort of what we're seeing here. But you're right, it's very early. And I think, you know, you're looking at these House races, you could be looking at $1, $2 million as a price tag, maybe more. Particularly in the Washington suburbs, because the D.C. media market's so expensive. And so it's very early, right? These are just drops in the bucket. But it is sort of tea leaves that we can all read at this point to try to get a sense for what's happening.
John Fritzy of The Sun, thank you very much for this catch-up.
Thanks for having me on.
Yep, we'll have you on again, John. Thank you very much. Now we turn to Chris Connolly of the WYPR news staff. Chris, we spoke the other day after the 90-day session of the General Assembly, which you covered. They closed out Monday night. With this lingering question, a lingering question about what, if anything, the new governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan's going to do with that $200 million that the legislature sort of set aside over here for education, health, pay for state workers.
Yep.
And the governor says, well, you might have put it there, but I don't have to spend it and I'm not going to. There's talk about, and The Sun had a story on this overnight saying that there might be a need for a special session of the legislature to settle this. So what do you think about this? What do you know so far?
Well, so in that $200 million is $68 million, which goes to a piece of the education funding puzzle called GCEI. So stick with me. It's a little bit in the weeds. The Geographic Cost of Education Index. This basically is an extra pot of money that's not part of the mandatory funding formula. So it's optional. That goes to the 13 districts where it costs the most to educate kids, to run schools. So, you know, Montgomery County, Prince George's County, Baltimore City, Baltimore County, and going down the list. Hogan only funded about half of that this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's $68 million that the General Assembly wanted him to fund. They put that in that fenced off $200 million. Hogan could choose not to spend it, but they also did this thing that totally puts him in a bind, frankly, right now, where they passed a bill that said if he does not fully fund GCEI, add that extra $68 million in, then starting next year, it becomes a mandatory piece of the funding puzzle. So he won't have the option.
And they already passed that.
They passed that. They took this bill out that had been proposed before and kind of dusted it off. And in the last couple of days, when it looked like they were really getting nowhere with the governor, sort of moved it along very quickly and made it a thing. And they framed it in this way that basically says, you know, either fund it now or fund it next year. The question is, will the governor veto it? Will he sign it? If he vetoes it, that raises the question of a special session, because they would have to basically come back into order, the legislature would, and override his veto. They have the votes for it. It's not 100% clear that that's exactly what they would do, but they're definitely keeping it open as an option.
Is there any sense that Hogan may have softened on this at all the last few days?
His language has softened a little bit, but not substantially. I talked to his folks today, and they said, you know, he's reviewing the bill, he's considering it. You know, he'll make a decision down the road.
Okay.
So we'll see.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris.
Sure thing.
Chris Connolly, who covered the legislature for WYPR. Flavio Sala is in the studio with us, as I promised. He's going to play some more on his guitar. So go right ahead, Flavio. Play for us. I can't promise everything you ever wanted to know about Little Italy, but we can certainly offer a nice sampling of stories about the people who once lived there and who still live there. Susanna Rosamolino has written a new book about the old neighborhood. She's going to join us on Midday next. So please stay with us. Flavio. Flavio Sala. S-A-L-A. What were you just playing? What are you playing?
A beautiful Neapolitan song.
I would say it's beautiful. Yeah. I'm practically in tears over here. I'm verklempt.
No, seriously.
What is it called?
I te vuria vasa. That means I would like to kiss you. No, no, not to you. But I
maybe
mean,
Susanna, she's
Susanna,
in the studio.
Maybe.
Hi, Susanna.
Yes.
Susanna Rosamolino is in the studio with us as well. Susanna, nice to have you with us.
Buon pomeriggio.
Isn't he nice?
Very.
Flavio?
Very bravo.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Flavio.
Italian?
Si.
Si. Oh, well, great.
Italiano Americano.
Flavio just performed at Germano's Piattini in Little Italy.
Yeah.
And this Sunday, he's doing a free online concert. You can go to his website, flaviosala.com, at 3 o'clock Sunday and listen to a live concert. How long do you think you'll go? As long as...
Till they want.
As long, you know, as, long they want. As they want.
Yes, as long as they want. And so if they join my list, they get free music download.
Excellent. They get free what?
Music download.
Music download.
Yes.
Okay. Flavio, thank you very much for being here again.
My pleasure.
We're going to hear some more from Flavio as we move along here. I think it's safe to say that with all its restaurants and its annual festivals and its location near Baltimore's Inner Harbor, Little Italy is one of the city's best-known and popular neighborhoods, and it really smells good a lot. It's not as big as it used to be in terms of the Italian immigrants or Italian-Americans who live there, but it survives. And the people who live there or drive in from the suburbs to still attend Mass or functions at St. Leo's Church cling to their traditions. I mentioned some before, the bocce games, the annual festivals. St. Anthony, St. Gabriel, and, of course, in March, the annual ravioli spaghetti dinner. So Susanna Rosamolino joins us now to tell a more intimate story of Little Italy, which she has put into this book, and I've really been enjoying your book, Susanna. So thank you
Dan.
Very much.
Thank
it's,
you.
It's called,
thank you
basically, Baltimore's Little Italy, Heritage and History of the Neighborhood. It's published by the History Press, and it's just out, and it's full of photographs, too. I'm going to ask you about some of the photographs here.
Absolutely.
It seems to me that...
That was harder than writing the book, to collect those.
Collect those.
Oh, yeah.
But it looks like St. Leo's Church, which is sort of the heart and center, the soul
Absolutely.
Of Little Italy.
The pulse of the neighborhood.
It also had quite a repository of photographs, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you got a lot of them?
No, a couple I did.
Just a couple?
I got them from all over.
Maybe it's the ones that jumped out at me. It seemed like there's a lot of photographs here of First Communion and parades through Little Italy that came from the church. But anyway.
Well, predominantly from Tom Scalapati, which is a photographer who is a photographer, still since age 17, and he provided me with many.
What's your first memory of Little Italy? Do you have a childhood memory of something there?
I grew up visiting my Aunt Angie and Uncle John Molino on Eden Street, and I was fascinated by their shotgun row house with the spiral staircase that my mother would never let me climb up, and I would sit at the bottom and look up and just so badly want to go into Aunt Angie's attic because I knew it was filled with treasures from around the world as they traveled. And my aunt and uncle lived there, probably for over 65 years. And my Aunt Angie was born there, grew up there, and unfortunately those two are passed. But the house was passed down to my brother, and he renovated it, and it's still in the family.
Excellent. Yeah. Will you call it a shotgun row house? You mean kind of small row house? Intimate?
Oh, yeah. Probably could put my hands this way and this way and
right.
touch both walls. Very skinny.
Right. Right.
As most of the houses down there are. Right. Very long.
Why did you want to write this book? It hasn't been done in a while.
It has not been done since 1974.
That's it. He wrote the last book, right?
Absolutely.
Sandler,
right? Yeah.
Baltimore Stories here on WYPR.
Absolutely, I have that. I just kept collecting history by accident as I was out and about with my work with Promotion Center for Little Italy. And the publisher actually found Promotion Center for Little Italy and asked if I could help them find a writer for this. They wanted to produce it. And it was always in the back of my head to do something with these snippets of history that I was collecting. But when they approached us, and I said, well, I'm a writer. So I, threw my hat in the ring, put in a proposal, and they accepted it, and we started a contract 1 year ago in February.
Now, you mentioned the Promotion Center for Little Italy. This is something you started.
That's right, in 2010.
Okay, mm-hmm. Because Little Italy needed promotion, would you say? I mean, what got you
it
to
did.
Do that?
I always believe in creating what I want to do in my life, so I wanted to work in Little Italy. So
okay.
I met with
you really like this neighborhood.
I really love the neighborhood. And of course, my grandparents started there from when they came from Abruzzi. And they started on Eden Street in that very house I was just speaking of. So, we go the Molino name goes way back.
So when I ask you about Little Italy needing promotion, this question has come up. For years it was a destination for everybody. When you're going to have dinner in Baltimore, maybe you go to Hausner's, you go to Little Italy. Everybody's probably been to Little Italy at some point for a dinner. And then in recent years, well, there aren't as many restaurants as there used to be. We've seen some restaurants close, and we've seen
still a good number.
Yeah, it's still a good number.
And still some opening.
Right. So, but I mean, did you get into the promoting of the neighborhood because you felt it needed it? Maybe in the past it didn't need it so much.
Well, this was all accidental, really. And as I started to meet with a few people with the idea for this, we knew that the parish and the Pandola Learning Center and the Columbus Day parades and all of the other nonprofit components of Little Italy, they were all doing their events, but we felt like we needed a center and a point person to filter all of that through. So, I'd like to think I help each of those components and events and in whatever way we can through website, more consistent communication, the newsletter we put out. Yeah.
Susanna good. Rosa Molino is our guest. Baltimore's Little Italy is the name of her book. If you'd like to ask a question or share a memory here of Little Italy or ask a question, 410-662-8780 is the number here for live talk on Midday. So tell me something you learned about Little Italy you didn't know before you did this book.
Well, I have a lot of favorite stories, and one of my favorites is the fact that during the war, World War II, when the United States had brought over many, many POWs from Italy and Germany and housed them all around the states, the Baltimore's Italian community used to go visit them over at Fort Meade. It was then called Camp Meade. And brought them food and had picnics and invited them into their home.
I'm so glad you brought this up.
Yeah.
Because this is one of the photographs I was going to ask you about.
Okay.
And I remember reading about Italian prisoners of war being at, like you say, Camp Meade and mm-hmm. German prisoners
and,
of war.
And favored. They were favored over the Germans.
Yeah, because the Germans they sent to Western Maryland and the Eastern Shore. And anyway, So there's a picture in here of people from Little Italy dressed in their Sunday best, visiting some of these prisoners mm-hmm. at Camp Meade.
That's right. They would go. They would have line after line of cars, and their picnic baskets. And I think it was mostly on Sundays they would traipse over there together. And you know, funny that from that, you know, I don't know about many, but some marriages came about from the some women in Baltimore's Italian community, you know, in Little Italy, and the prisoners of war. So they never went home.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you a little surprised by this? Because I was surprised that they would allow them to have visitors.
I was surprised. I was surprised that they allowed them to leave. My Aunt Olga and Uncle John, who lived in Dundalk, would have them at their home.
The POWs?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They came over for what? Sunday dinner or something?
That's what I was told.
That's kind of funny. Yeah. They must have been most favored. Okay. That's a cool thing to learn.
That was a very cool thing to learn. It fascinated me.
You know, I asked the trivia question and sort of gave the answer. I said, you know, what neighborhood in Baltimore produced two mayors and the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives?
Nancy Pelosi, right?
Well, it's actually just one family, right?
Just one family.
All right. So for those who don't know, fill us in.
Do politics on me here.
It's not politics. It's history. Fill us in on the D'Alessandro family.
Well, I do include them in the book. And I learned, you know, as I was going along, how strong of a family they were in the neighborhood. And my favorite part about that was reading how the Mrs. D'Alessandro, who was, they say, the real politician.
Big Nancy.
Would, you know, gather all her little Italian friends in their aprons, and they would come over and help her campaign in their house.
Help her campaign? You mean help out with the mayor?
Just help out, you know.
Right. We have to explain something for people who don't know. That the mayor of Baltimore, Thomas D'Alessandro Jr., he was the first member of that family to become mayor. Then his son, Tommy D'Alessandro III, became
right.
mayor of Baltimore.
The younger Tommy, right.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Nancy, the daughter, the only girl in the family, became Nancy Pelosi, the
right.
Speaker of the U.S. House of
yeah.
Representatives.
I need to send her a book.
Yeah. Have a book signing. Have her come to Baltimore. Flavio, want to play for us a little bit more? Flavio Sala is going to play a little tune here. We'll take another break here on the Midday Show. 410-662-8780 is our number. Here as we talk about the history of Little Italy. We'll get into more of the history when we get back here with Susanna Rosa Molino. Italy, Heritage and History of the Neighborhood, published by the History Press, written by Susanna Rosa Molino, who's in our studio today. And that's Flavio Sala playing. What are you playing, Flavio? What is that?
This is Una Limosna para el Amor de Dios, de Agustin Barrios from Paraguay.
Mm.
It's a tremolo piece, this special technique.
Sounds like a mandolin to me.
Yes.
Grazie. Bravo.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Susanna, here's a story. Let me ask you this. Is it true during the Great Baltimore Fire of 1904, when downtown Baltimore was burning, the people in Little Italy prayed that the fire would stop and the wind would change and
That's
blow?
That's a great story.
Is that a true story?
It is a true story. And you might hear different variations. The basic story goes like this. As you were saying, the 1904 fire was burning. It was heading toward Little Italy. The people of the neighborhood were pouring water on their roofs to stop the ashes from, you know, catching. They all, not all, but many ran down to the Jones Falls and prayed to St. Anthony to spare the neighborhood. There supposedly one man was visited. He ran down the street all hysterical. He was visited by St. Anthony and he was told the neighborhood will be spared. He bust into one of the boarding houses, and it was a tavern actually, and said, I've been visited by St. Anthony and the neighborhood's going to be saved. And so anyway, they prayed and prayed and prayed, and miraculously the wind did shift. And the fire did go elsewhere, and the neighborhood was saved. The people vowed then and there that they would honor St. Anthony with an annual festival. And that began in 1904 and has continued to this day with a little hiccup of an interruption, I think, during the war.
One of the wars?
Yeah.
World War II, maybe? Not sure.
Not recalling.
One of those. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, that's held in June every year.
June, for right. That Feast of St. Anthony in June, Feast of St. Gabriel in August.
You know, it's a great visual of people lined up along the water break, the Jones Falls, where it comes into the inner harbor down there. And of course, if the wind doesn't shift, the water's not going to stop a fire that was raging
exactly.
in downtown. So it's a very believable story.
Yeah, yeah.
But St. Leo's Church, as I said before, is like the center of the neighborhood, really, the heart
Since
and soul of the neighborhood.
1881.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was already named St. Leo's. So I always wondered why they didn't just name the church St. Anthony out of respect to the saint that saved
right.
them. So.
Yeah, that, right. That's been.
Yeah, but it was already named.
Absolutely.
You can't rename. It's like a boat. Yeah. You can't rename a church.
Right.
410-662-8780. It's bad luck, too. Anyway, Christine is calling us from White Marsh.
Hi, Christine.
Hi. Hello. Dan, I'm a great fan of your show. I listen to it as often as I can.
Oh, thank you.
I was calling because I know one of those ladies personally who married a POW during World War II.
Really?
And yes, she is 90 years old. She's a good friend of mine. I visit her a few times a week. And she went there because she thought one of her uncles may be there. We have been there and she would visit. And then she met her future husband. But she told me they weren't allowed to marry in the States. He had to go back to Italy. And she was very brave. She saved her money. She went there on her own and married, came back. And he's passed away now, but they were married for, you know, almost a little over 60 years.
Wow. And she's still alive?
She's still alive. She's well. She's 90 years old. Well, in August, she'll be 91.
You know, I'd like to know more about this story. Christine, could you stay on the line and give your name and phone number to my producer?
Sure.
That sounds like a story to me. I've always
Absolutely.
Been interested in this story. I'm glad it's mentioned in your book. I remember going into the Baltimore Sun Library once and reading a story about German POWs who worked in orchards in Western Maryland, farms and orchards in Western Maryland, and farms and, I think, like timber camps on the Eastern Shore cutting down trees. And there was one German prisoner after the war wrote to a farmer, the farmer he had stayed with, lived mm-hmm. with in Western Maryland, saying he wanted to come back. Things were so bad in Europe, in Germany after the war, and he really loved it there that he'd come back for free, work for free to live on his farm. It was a letter that the Baltimore Sun published. So this whole idea of POWs in World War II being here in our midst, and then you've got this great photograph in here of this outing from Baltimore.
That's from my
from Little Italy.
My cousin Johnny Manna gave me that photograph, and he, as a young boy, used to go visit them with his mom and dad, Mary and Patsy.
It's always interesting in Little Italy to see how it's changed over the years. I say it's smaller in terms of the number of people, you know, immigrants.
But not the boundaries. The boundaries are,
physically, it's the same. Right?
It is. I was surprised to come across that actually, but it is.
But the number of people who, you know, Italian immigrants who come to Little Italy, that doesn't happen that often.
Not so much
anymore. Not so much.
Not in the waves it once did.
Right. They moved out to the suburbs a lot. But a lot of people stayed.
Mm-hmm. They moved over also to Highlandtown. The wave kept going from Little Italy over to Highlandtown. And then people moved up and out.
Up and out
to the east. But they come back. They come back to support the church. and the events. There's so many people that come back. It's wonderful. If you talk to people who grew up there, they just have so many wonderful stories.
Well, we mentioned the D'Alessandro family. There's some other people we can talk about here. Mugavero.
Muggs.
Or Mugavero Muggs, we just called
him. Did you know Muggs?
Marianne, yes.
Marianne, yeah.
This is a very nice man to me, and it was a real character who had a corner, I guess you'd call it, not a confectionery, but
well, it was originally called that.
It originally was a confectionery, but
then it was just nicknamed Muggs's Corner.
Yeah, you got a sandwich
all
there.
All the kids hung out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what I always liked about it? He had one of those wooden phone booths.
Mm-hmm.
A real wooden phone booth built into the wall, and I could go in there and pretend I was a reporter, you know, making a phone call.
Yeah, that's so a famous phone booth.
Change
that
my,
phone
into
booth
Superman
is
costume.
In his daughter's basement now.
Oh, she has it?
She has it, Gail.
That's good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was a wonderful man who lived into his 90s.
Yeah, God rest his soul. He was fun. Mm.
And then there's Rosie Apicella.
Right.
Am
Rosie
I right?
Still plays bocce.
Now, let me tell you.
She's a character. Do you know Rosie?
Rosie is a tremendous bocce roller.
She is.
She's tremendous.
Yeah, one of the best. Dino Basso,
And so one year, it was the St. Anthony or the St. Gabriel Festival, and she's doing Ciparelli's salad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she
has a lot of energy, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She runs over, she mixes the salad, and then she goes play bocce.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't really wipe her hands that well from the olive oil, and it gets on the bocce ball, and it threw a game off, you know, threw a game off a little bit. So anyway,
that's funny.
Who are some of your favorite people from Little Italy?
That I would have liked to was Tony DeSales. Are you aware of him, Little Italy's artist?
I was
fascinated with his entire story, and I enjoyed getting more information from his sisters. That was a wonderful piece of the neighborhood. He stood in the corner for, well over 35 years.
Through all kinds of weather.
Mm-hmm, and sketched his little heart out. And my favorite part of his story was he would hand out postcards of his sketches to all the tourists, and he would just say to them, when you get home, write to me. And they would send the postcards back. And he got many, many, many from around the world.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I happen to have seen those.
Did you see the book his sister put out?
Unbelievable.
Rita, it was beautiful.
So he stood at the corner. It used to be, what was the restaurant?
Well, he stood in front of Ciparelli's mostly, and then across the street. Rocco's sometimes.
Rocco's, Capriccio.
Yeah, Capriccio, okay.
So then you're right. He'd give these postcards to people, say, when you get home, mail them to me.
Mm-hmm.
This went on for years, and Tony DeSales got all these. It was amazing how many postcards he had received.
And
from
he
people.
Was so much more than that around the neighborhood. Another fun thing I came across, and his sister sent me these from California, Rita. He used to handwrite a newsletter called Piccolo, which means small. And he was very sarcastic, but he was very good writer.
Mm-hmm.
And she sent me a stack, yay big. And I read every word, and I was very entertained by him.
Well, he had an acerbic wit. And very political,
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, there's some celebrities in your book,
there are.
Susanna. The photographs here.
A couple of Yankees.
Yankees. There's a beautiful picture of a 19-year-old Mickey Mantle having, stopping for a dinner at Roma Restaurant.
That's right.
Right?
Around 1950.
Yes. And I think, does it say he's 19 years old?
It doesn't say. He's with, it was after an Oriole game, and he's with Whitey Ford.
Okay, I'm sorry, I don't know how I got
others.
That he was 19. Anyway, he's there with Whitey Ford and Moose Scour, and it's a great, great photograph.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I guess visiting ball players, baseball or football, Little Italy would be a place they went,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Little Italy has been visited by many, many, many celebrities, presidents,
and there's a
vice
picture,
presidents.
There's a picture of Perry Como in here.
Mm-hmm.
Perry Como visiting Little Italy restaurant.
1953.
And if I'm not mistaken, Spiro Agnew, after pleading no contest to tax evasion, went over to Sabatino's and
I
had dinner.
I read that. I did. Mm-hmm. That was one of his favorites.
It's a destination for
his favorite.
Convicted felons.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a picture of Steve Lawrence, mm-hmm, the singer Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. But he's not in the photo. In the photograph, there's no Edie Gourmet. There's just Emma Machioko.
Mama Emma.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, she entertained a lot of celebrities.
And Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
President Reagan
came in 1984 to dedicate the Columbus Piazza.
Now,
there's a picture
of
him here.
And Baltimore has three Columbus statues.
I know.
You know, it's like different groups all competing to have a better Columbus statue. I think there's one in Druid Hill Park. There's one out in where is it?
North
Hamilton, somewhere out there, and there's one in Little Italy.
There's two in Druid Hill Park. The one, like, I'm not sure if the original one is still there. I think that
they moved one at some point.
And then they put up another one.
Flavio Sala is going to play for us again. Are you going to play another Italian piece? What do you feel like playing for us?
You can
play. I want you to play whatever you like.
Let's do the Tarantella.
Oh, Tarantella. No, I have no Tarantella now.
No, he's moved on to
more,
jazz,
more
classical.
Mellow.
I can play the one from Bocelli. Time to say goodbye.
No, I don't want to say goodbye yet. We got another 7 or 8 minutes. What else? What else you got?
Okay, I will play another from South America, and then
we'll
finish
fine.
With
it.
Italian.
It doesn't have to be Italian. Yeah.
Okay.
It's Flavio Sala on the Midday Show. Good, Flavio. Oh,
thank
man.
Thank you so much.
You are good. How old are you, Flavio?
32 next May.
And how long have you been playing the guitar?
Since I was born.
Really?
I was 7 when I started. And
wow.
I spent all my energy playing guitar. Well, I have been spending.
You know, I mentioned that you played at Germano's Cabaret. That's Germano's restaurant in Little Italy.
Yes, and it was great. They invited me to play.
Had you played there before?
No, that was my first time. And, I mean, it was really beautiful. And so they invited me to play again on June. I will play a solo concert on June 6th. And with the Cuban pianist Cesar Orozco on June 18th. So we will make this debut as duo. We played together in Venezuela. So now we live here and we met, and it's really beautiful.
He's Cuban. His name is Cesar Orozco.
Cesar Orozco.
He lives here now?
He lives, not far from Baltimore.
For more information about all those events that Flavio just mentioned, you can go to his website, flaviosala.com.
Yes.
And this Sunday at 3:00, if you want to listen to more of him performing live as a free online concert through his website. And, you know, Susanna, that's an interesting thing that Germano and his wife, Sid,
mm-hmm.
did there.
Great folks, great people.
Yeah, so here they have it's Germano's Trattoria for many years, and they say, well, we got to do something. We're going to innovate a little bit, and we're going to have live music up on the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
So they took that space, and on the weekends, and I think some weeknights, too.
Every day.
Yeah.
Oh, is it every day?
Almost every day,
great
yes.
Entertainers.
Yes, of course, mostly on the weekend, mm-hmm. like Thursday, Friday, Saturday. But sometimes they have very busy schedule.
Yeah,
and
they have quite the lineup.
Yes, and it's very nice. They have dinner at 6:00 and music at 7:30. So after dinner, people just see the area, you know, they're drinking maybe some wine and with live music. It's just beautiful.
And would
and
you
it's
say
just for 70 people.
Just 70 people in that space.
Yes.
Would you say it's mostly jazz?
It's mostly jazz, yes. Jazz, mm-hmm. Latin jazz, pop, I mean, singers, and yeah. They have a piano there, so it's really fantastic.
It's nice to see. I just mentioned it because of the innovation it suggests in Little Italy, somebody trying to do something different mm-hmm. there, right? And how many, where are we on the restaurant count in Little Italy, can you say?
Almost 30 counting bakeries, bars, carryouts, restaurants,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's Vaccaro's,
mm-hmm.
and what else I was going to mention? Oh, the
Pied di Grotta, do you
Pied
know
Pied di Grotta, now.
Best kept secret.
Can we mention Pied di Grotta? Because everyone talks about Vaccaro's, mm-hmm. but these nice couple, Bruna and her husband.
Bruna and Carmen Antonio.
Antonio. So this
No, that's his whole first name. Carmen Antonio.
Carmen Antonio.
Yeah.
I always have to ask what
nice
his name
people.
Is. Bruna is easier
yeah,
to remember.
They're both from Italy.
Now, Pied di Grotta
Pied
di
Grotta.
Across Central Avenue, right?
Correct. It's on Bank. They're in the old tack factory.
Right. Where people will know it from the Heavy Seas. Heavy
mm-hmm.
Seas Saloon there on the corner.
On the corner, correct.
Right on that street there on Bank.
Mm-hmm.
This guy.
Great space.
These people really know how to bake, right?
Oh, yeah.
They have all kinds of goodies there. Very good. So
She taught me to put Parmesan in my scrambled eggs. That's what I do now.
It took you this long in life to learn
that?
That's
right.
Your name is Susanna Rosa Molino. You're just figuring this out?
My mother didn't do it. What can I say?
That's very funny. That's very funny. Well, anyway, congratulations on getting your book published, this history of Little Italy. There's one other celebrity story I want to mention from Little Italy. It was on a St. Anthony or St. Gabriel festival. I went into the Sons of Italy Lodge.
Mm-hmm. Of which you're a member.
I'm a member mm-hmm. now, yeah. And there's a bingo game going on.
Every month.
But the name, the voice calling out the bingo is B4, G7, and it's Chuck Thompson.
Chuck Thompson.
The guy used to do the Orioles games.
He loved
Little calling,
Italy.
He loved Little Italy.
He did.
And he's doing the bingo game. Mm-hmm. I heard Chuck Thompson do a bingo. It was amazing.
That's funny.
In Little Italy. You never know what you're going to find in Little Italy.
You go to their Friday night dinners, I heard, sometimes,
yeah,
right?
I got to get them. Yeah. I should get them more often because they're really good. It's
yeah,
a good
very
deal.
Good. You talk about a great, great volunteer
and
base.
And it's a great
it's
scene, too.
Lodge.
All those people gathering there on Friday nights. Yep.
Lots of fun.
Susanna Rosa Molino's book is Baltimore's Little Italy, Heritage and History of the Neighborhood. I really love that last piece you played, Flavio.
It was Alma Llanera. It's a very famous song from Venezuela. They used to play in any shows.
play anything you like here, Flavio, because you're going to finish the show for us now. We're going to say goodbye to everybody. It's not a sad goodbye.
No, okay.
Not a sad goodbye.
Not a sad goodbye.
You got something, a nice goodbye like...
Yes. Well, I would like to invite people to join my mail list because they will get free music download and we can keep in touch. Thank you so much. And
thank
I will
you.
Play now how a song from Venezuela. Very beautiful.
Great. Flavio Sala. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please come back on Monday. Enjoy the music as we go into our the NPR news at the top of the hour, and then you get... Science Friday, right?
Yeah.
And Dan
Roddick. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you,
I appreciate
Susanna.
It, Dan.
This is Dan Roddick for our staff here. Have a great weekend.
Producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Alexis Kuhn, Aaron Lorenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spickman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.